This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a call for Bernie Sanders to leave the Democrats after the convention in Philadelphia to run as an independent. And the Black Is Back Coalition will organize forums around the country to create a national Black political agenda. But first, thousands of teachers went on sick out in Detroit last Monday and Tuesday, shutting down the city's public schools. The sick out was led by Steve Kahn, who was elected president of the local teachers union, but deposed at the urging of the National American Federation of Teachers. Steve Kahn and activists from the BAM organization, By Any Means Necessary, have been holding teacher sick-outs since November to protest Governor Rick Snyder's efforts to privatize the public schools, which are already more than half charter.
It's about fighting the governor's plan to destroy the schools, the so-called Snyder plan. Governor Snyder's got to replace public education in Detroit with a charter model school and a school district that would essentially be a state recovery receivership district, which in Michigan is called the EAA, which he's set up over the last few years, which has been a total disaster. It's the worst, most infamously pathetic school system in the state. And really what he's doing is trying to make the new Detroit public school starting next year would literally be a new school district. It would be run as the EAA. And not by name, but as far as we can see, everything else. And we just kind of fight that and fight for real progress in education, such as lowering class size and getting the students the books they need and the supplies and providing teachers with the pay and support they need to attract and retain teachers and help them educate. And the governor is opposed to that. And I think we were out on the picket lines and we're marching to victory. We really were. But the national union, Randy Weingarten and her local flunkies convinced the teachers or browbeat the teachers to going back to work. And as such, they have snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. And we are borderline now on some real historical defeat here. The legislation right now is in a conference committee. You've got a House bill and a Senate bill, and they're not quite aligned. In some sense, they're very aligned. In some sense, there is some distance between them, and the AFT's position essentially is let the conservative Republican Governor Snyder, trust him to work it out on our behalf. I mean, that more or less is it, their position. Evidently, they feel they've worked out a secret kind of behind-the-scenes deal with this governor, in spite of the fact that the same governor was supposedly against right to work when he first became governor, but the deal broke. In the end, he went back on the deal and signed right to work in the state of Michigan. And this right to work governor is somebody that apparently the AFT national leadership believes in. It believes they have a deal. And it's a deal is the only thing it possibly provides us that we can see is the automatic dues checkoff for next year in the new district. The new district will be called Detroit Community Schools. It'll be a completely different district than the current district. Maybe the same buildings, could well be different teachers, all sorts of different things that are much more aligned with an EAA private or charter, I should say, charter state receivership district. It's all beatable. It's all something we could defeat, but we really need to get back out on the picket lines now with sick outs and a strike. It was a hugely popular strike. We had the people of Detroit all aligned with us and could have pressed on for victory. And Snyder knew it, and the Democratic mayor knew it, Mayor Duggan, and Randy Weingarten, the AFT national president, knew it. And it's really because of that popularity that they ended it, and Weingarten specifically ended it. And the teachers are just being used and are going to lose greatly in this, although it's some possibility, at least in theory, that the AFT remains a dues checkoff next year. I'm not so sure in practice it's very likely, but in theory. But the theory of the deal is terrible for the teachers. It really is sacrifice all their rights and conceivably large amounts of their pay in order to form an alliance with the governor for a new district that would have a dues checkoff.
If the fate of the public school systems as a public enterprise is really what's at stake, how could the head of a national union of teachers try to act as a mediator in such a battle?
Oh, I agree. And it's not even so much so that she's a mediator. She is just leading us down the road of destruction. But I think the bottom line is that her fear of the people of Detroit, her fear of the student population, the young people especially, poor of Detroit, the black population of Detroit, black and Latino population of Detroit, she does not want to organize. She does not want to do anything that could lead to their rebellion against the oppressive, terrible anti-education conditions in the schools. And anytime the teachers are out there, you're talking about a mass picket of 2,000-3,000 people. Day in, day out, that encourages people, that says, hey, it's right to rebel. People are rebelling. Let's step up and fight. And her attitude is she's got to stop that. She cannot be part of that. That is her political position. Meanwhile, she is naively, stupidly, I would phrase it, in alliance with the governor and thinks that the governor is her ally. It's just the next step after years of sucking up and drawing alliances with some of the most awful Democratic politicians. It led to alliances with Democrats around No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top that were so destructive of the teachers' rights and the students' futures. Continuing with her policy, just taking it to a new level, let's put it that way, what she's doing here, a new low.
Now, the teachers have been going on sick out, not just to protest paycheck issues, but also about the deterioration of the Detroit public schools, which you see as part and parcel of the drive by the governor and other forces to privatize the school system.
Yeah, I see the part and parcel of the drive to privatize the school system and intensify the racist segregation. And the teachers were rebelling against those conditions and the waves of sick outs. They were rebelling against the Snyder Plan. What made it into the news media was not so much the latter, which the news media tried to black out, but the former, that is the building conditions, the physical conditions. The iconic picture of the mushroom growing out of the wall of one of our schools. There were other pictures that went viral. A photo of an empty swimming pool, all sorts of things. And that's the main thing that the news media nationally covered, but tended to black out the issue of us fighting against Snyder's, the governor's plans to privatize. And the teachers have stuck to their guns and continue to fight. But in this last round, which was at least in numbers bigger than ever before, this last round of sick outs, Monday, Tuesday, which shut down all the schools, but was in the media and also in Weingarten's view, just centered on the question of pay, and particularly one piece of the pay. Outrageous as it was, the district was saying suddenly that they were not going to pay people over the summer money that they earned during the school year. So many of our teachers, about 3/4 of them, I think, have a spread the pay system in which the district pays them less throughout the year, keep holding on to some of their money, and then pays out over the summer when they aren't working. Well, the district under the state manager, retired federal judge Rhodes, the same guy who carried out the destruction of the pension system recently in Detroit. And he retired after that to a very nice pension himself, but he's come back part-time to run the school district. He's a bankruptcy judge, and he's working a part-time job, and he's here as the head of Detroit Public Schools, the governor's agent, and he suddenly announced, we don't have the money to pay next summer, even though these are teachers who have worked this year and earned the money and are to be paid out. So in a narrow sense, that was the base of the sick outs. But truth is, the teachers are very upset with the Snyder Plan and knew that it was dangerous and coming. And the media, and most especially Weingarten and her local agents within the Detroit Federation, that would include most especially the people that threw me out of the union office, even though I was the elected president, those people were just adamant and just against the struggle around the issue of the Snyder Plan and narrowed the issue simply to that single pay question. And we went back as teachers after 2 days, in some sense, not even having won on the pay question, because all we got on the pay question was a promise to pay, which is really what we have in the contract anyway. It's a very weak contract, but it does say you'll be paid this amount of money for your work. Well, all they did was issue a statement saying, we promise to pay you. Legally, institutionally, it's of no greater value and arguably much less value than the contract itself if it does come down to a court fight in the future. We didn't win anything else. And so teachers felt very dissatisfied to begin with, and then especially dissatisfied when the Snyder Plan intensified in the days immediately after the sick out, in the sense that there were other amendments added to it as a retaliation for the sick out. What we did in sicking out for those 2 days is started a fight, but decided not to finish it. And in politics, I guess you could say, in warfare, whatever else, if you start, you better finish. It can be very successful, but you've got to finish. Otherwise, it can be a disaster. And that's what we're heading towards here, a real catastrophe for the teachers.
That was Steve Kahn, the former head of the Detroit Teachers Union. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations plans events in a number of cities to put together a national black political agenda. The project came out of a Black is Back Coalition national conference in Harlem last month. Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshetela explains.
The timing is excellent that we couldn't have planned the existing context better than how they have occurred in real life. In terms of the political anxiety that is being experienced by many of the people who are engaged in electoral politics and many who see electoral politics as the only way forward. So there's been this anxiety about whether or not people are going to have to accept a Trump candidacy and what that's going to mean for black people and others around the world, and especially how will black people be affected by a Trump candidacy. There's a disillusionment with many of the people in our communities who are considered leftists or progressives, et cetera, with Hillary Clinton, whose reputation is extraordinarily rank, smelly, what have you, and whose participation in various kinds of policy determinations that have been so detrimental to our community becoming increasingly well-known. So many people who call themselves progressives and leftists in our community were unable to work with her. Then we, you know, have Bernie Sanders, to whom certainly some progressive and leftists in our community attach their hopes and aspirations to. The thing that was really notoriously obvious about each of the candidates that were the outstanding representatives of the electoral possibilities for our people, each of them failed to have any kind of substantive discussion or raise any critical questions that are important to our people, to black people. So we were trapped with this apparent option only of a Democrat or a Republican or a quote-unquote progressive or Democratic Socialist Democrat, what they like to characterize as a moderate Democrat, and Bernie and Donald Trump. And the coalition was right on time in saying that we don't have to settle for a narrative or an outcome that's being determined by these folk who are tied to the ruling establishment, that we have a responsibility and an obligation to enter into this discussion forcefully and to say that we can speak for ourselves and have an agenda of our own that would struggle to influence the direction, certainly the political direction for black people, African people in this country. And that was part of the context. As I said, there was a tremendous amount and continues to be a tremendous level of anxiety based on the electoral process as it's playing itself out in the presidential context. So we said we can do this on our own. And part of what we're thinking about is being able to use the basic principles of unity of the coalition. We have to look at them, and we know what it has taken to make a successful coalition that's lasted for 7 years or more. Principles of unity that unified us based on self-determination and based on anti-imperialist kind of politics. So let's use this as the basis of sponsoring conferences that could happen throughout the United States between now and our annual mobilization that happens in Washington, D.C., that's scheduled now for November 5th and 6th, where we have our traditional rally. and we have our march on the White House, and we have our conference, and this time the rally, the march and the conference would be reflective of the conferences that we'll have between now and then, where we want to offer an opportunity for masses of black people to come together in various different cities where we can make this happen. Certainly places like Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Washington, D.C., St. Louis, et cetera, and probably other places as well. And people can come together in public assemblies to discuss a national black political agenda for our people, and then have these kinds of conferences occur between now and November, and use these also as part of the process to mobilize people to Washington, D.C., carrying our own agenda that we'll take to certainly our mobilization and our conference that will occur some 2 or 3 days before the election for U.S. president.
It should be pointed out that some elements of the coalition have endorsed Bernie Sanders for president, most notably the Newark-based People's Organization for Progress. But this conversation that the coalition's talking about organizing would include, of course, those Sanders backers as well.
Of course, the problem is not that somebody backed Sanders. The problem is that we did not have a platform of our own that we could take into a discussion with anybody. The problem is that we end up having to back Sanders, hoping that Sanders' politic or Sanders' platform would represent us, and hoping that it would be a plausible lesser of two evils kind of thing. Even if we could look at Sanders as compared to Hillary Clinton, of course, and people could be excited about that, but that's not the kind of statement that we needed. And so it doesn't matter whether people were with Sanders, or even if they're Negroes who might have supported Trump. The question is, what is the foundation? What platform do we stand on as black people in this country when we enter into a political discussion with anybody? How do we take our own independent demands into that discussion? And the thing that we are working on now is to create our own agenda, is what will inform us as a group across the board in our relationships with any other political force that's out there.
Of course, shortly after the 2012 election, lots of the black political class were saying that they were going to get together and formulate a black political agenda, but nothing ever came of that.
Nothing could come of it, because for them to come with us would have meant they would have had to divorce the Democratic Party, which they've been in bed with for so long and were tied to in a thousand different ways through economics and other kinds of political influences that they might have had. Now, we're saying that this is a thing that should be helpful to anybody who's interested in really addressing our issues, because it gives even somebody who might have an instinct to sell out, or who might have an instinct to be on the right side of the issue, they can do it now without having to take responsibility for it. I didn't want to quit, boss, but those Negroes got together and they said, this is our platform, and so I got to stick with that. That's the kind of thing that we will offer anybody who wants an honest opportunity to break free, to wean themselves from this despicable system that's been bleeding and persecuting and committing all kinds of atrocities against our people up to now.
And this proposed black political agenda is not solely about, or even necessarily primarily about, electoral politics.
It's not about electoral politics. It should inform us in the same way that the best of the political utterances of Malcolm X, when he was defining for us in quite concrete terms what it is that we should be struggling for: control of our communities, control of our economy, control of our political life, etc. And similarly, people like Marcus Garvey did similar kinds of things. And it wasn't something that simply had to do with an election, but it had to do with our lives and how do we intervene in the affairs of our communities wherever we are located in a fashion that pushes a common agenda for self-determination.
Lots of folks, when they speak of a black political agenda, leave foreign affairs and international perspective entirely out of the conversation.
And this has been an error. You know, even when Martin Luther King considered speaking out on Vietnam, especially under the influence of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that had really taken up an anti-war position and had struck out in support of the Palestinians. And when Martin Luther King was considering addressing this question, he was advised by everybody who was close to him, white liberals and people in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference itself, not to do it, that this was territory that one shouldn't enter into. And Malcolm X, as you know, who was really the leader who did most to take our struggles and issues onto an international agenda, many people even said that that was part of what contributed to the need by the United States government to kill him. So this is something that many times we've been timid about, and sometimes we've been narrow-minded about in terms of not being able to see that African people, black people, do not live in some kind of vacuum, that we are part of the world, and the things that are determining how politics occurring in this country often don't have their origin in the country, but have the origin in things that's happening around the world. And so it's critical that our community be able to take on and examine what's happening internationally. It's critical that we are able to identify our friends outside of this country who might otherwise be allies and people we can look at as allies and supporters, but also whom we can support as a part of our responsibility as conscious, active political forces. The brutal murder that we see happening before our eyes in places like occupied Palestine, that's something that we all ought to have an opinion about. The situation that we see in places like Brussels and Paris, where Muslims are easily condemned because of the sometimes expressions of resistance that results in bombings here, bombings there, and this one-sided discussion about the poor Parisians or the poor Belgians without any look at the context of what Paris, what France and Belgium have been doing for centuries and continue to do now in places where they occupy militarily. We need to have an opinion about that, and we certainly need to have an opinion about these military bases, not only the near 1,000 military bases spread around the world, the U.S. military bases, but also about those in Africa, especially AFRICOM, but more than AFRICOM, how France itself is dominating something like 14 different countries in Africa, bleeding Africa, responsible for virtually every contradiction. We need to talk about the United Nations occupation of Haiti, which is almost the same thing as saying the U.S. occupation of Haiti, that's been responsible for horrible consequences, health consequences, and political consequences that people have to live with even today. We need to have an opinion on this, and we need to help our community understand some of these questions and speak out on these questions so that the authority of our community is extended beyond the city where we live or the country where we happen to be existing now throughout the rest of the world. Most conscious people do that. Certainly Jews do that to influence what's happening. Everybody, nobody condemns Jews for trying to determine what's happening throughout the Middle East and other places based on the perceived interests of that sector of the Jewish ruling class that is so influential. Other people do that as well. We have a responsibility to do that.
Donald Trump seems certain to lock up the Republican nomination. He's clearly presented himself as the white man's candidate, and there are great pressures for black people and for white progressives to drop everything and stop Trump.
That's true. That's absolutely true. It's just that we find ourselves, because we are without a center of our own that puts forth our own agenda by which each of the candidates would be measured, their significance, their relevance to us by this, and this would be a position of power compared to the lack of power that we have when we don't have an independent political voice, an independent political position that's out there. So, yeah, there's a lot of stop Trump kind of fear that's out there. I think that it's misplaced in the sense that, not that Trump might not be a horrible person, but certainly he's no more horrible than Hillary. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't see a dime worth of difference between Trump and the Zionist, who's called Bernie Sanders, in the final analysis. The question for us is, what is our agenda? And what tactics and strategies must we use after having achieved an agenda to mobilize enough people toward this accomplishment? But the big task we have right now is just to unite our community around this whole question of self-determination so that we are not there to be picked over by any person or any group that's out there who is looking after their own interests, and they can do it at our benefit because we haven't identified what our interests are.
There's always been talk of a black political party and sometimes efforts to actually create one, but what comes first, the party or the black agenda, the discussion of the politics that black folks should be pursuing?
And I think that's a critical question. I think that's where we are now. I truly believe that this is what makes the role of the coalition such a critical thing. I mean, we started off with a boom, but in terms of really pursuing well-defined political agenda, we haven't done that, and I think correctly we haven't done that. We have been moving further and further toward the acclamation that there must be self-determination, that self-determination is critical. And then there's also within the Black is Back coalition a strong tendency towards socialism. And the thing that makes me appreciative about all of this is because it's not just a sterile discussion, that we are actually engaged in doing stuff, and the work that we're doing now to build this black agenda is work that is designed, or certainly our intent is to change the narrative of people who actually engage in trying to change their lives, actually engage in trying to understand and deal with things in the world, not in an abstract way, but in all reality. So I believe that this is critical, and I think this is what's necessary for us to begin a reasonable kind of discussion about some kind of black electoral party, because we're helping to forge what this party could stand for. Because the thing is that the Democratic Party itself could and has been involved through its black cadre in efforts that we've made to build the so-called black political party. And this kind of politics helped to neutralize and make ineffectual our efforts, because too many instances what we found represented in what we were trying to make happen was the politic from other established powerful institutions without us having been clear on our own agenda. So I believe that this is what gives us a greater capacity to build such a political party. And I don't. This is not a static process. I mean, as you know, right now, some people who are affiliated with our coalition are very much into electoral politics and perhaps primarily into electoral politics in many ways, like the folk who are coming out of St. Louis, who's, for them, the immediate mission is to win this whole notion of electoral proportionate representation. It's a notion that there should be proportionate representation by black people throughout this country based on the numbers and percentages of Africans, and that should be reflected in all of the spheres of political power, etc. X numbers of governors, X numbers of senators and congresspersons, mayors, all of this. This is the position that's coming from that. Some people will say, well, that doesn't make sense, and perhaps it doesn't make sense standing on its own. But as a part of a general movement toward collecting an agenda for our community for self-determination, then it can be given some credence. And there are other kinds of positions out there which, left to themselves, may not be worth consideration, but which are part of an overall movement toward self-determination. We influence each other. It's a dynamic kind of process, not a static process, and the tactics and strategies that will be employed will be varied as well. And the thing is, if the common agenda or the common trajectory is toward self-determination, then I think we will win.
Omali Yeshetela of the Black is Back Coalition. In Seattle, Washington, City Councilwoman Kashama Sawant, head of the Socialist Alternative Party, has launched a petition calling on Bernie Sanders to run as an independent candidate for president after he fails to win the Democratic presidential nomination in Philadelphia this summer. Sawant says the nation needs a third party to represent the 99%. But what about the Green Party, which is already on the ballot, or will be, in a majority of states in November?
Well, I think that as supporters of Jill Stein in her 2012 presidential campaign, I would say that if the Jill Stein campaign this year is the most effective or the only left campaign that we can have, that we can rally supporters around, then I will absolutely be doing that. But as Jill herself has been saying, and many others on the left have been saying, we, and as our petition on Movement for Bernie website has been saying, we're urging Bernie to run as an independent to November if he doesn't get the Democratic nomination. And I would say, if there was any possibility of Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein running together on a Green Party ticket this year, that would be absolutely historic. I would support that wholeheartedly. And I think that something like that could help build a basis for an independent party at the 99%, which is the most critical project we have to get started on.
An independent party of the 99%. How would you characterize such a party? Something like what Bernie Sanders would call a Scandinavian social democratic party?
Well, I think that what we have in terms of, you know, just ground rules, what are the rules of thumb we would want to have for such a party? Obviously, we cannot create a party that will bring in the tens of thousands, indeed millions of people, especially young people who have rallied around the cry for a political revolution. If we make it absolutely prescriptive in the sense that, you know, I wouldn't say that everybody has to absolutely agree with everything that Socialist Alternative, my organization, says. At this time, I would be happy if people did. But I think a more realistic proposal is for us to agree on some ground rules, as I said, or rules of thumb. So what is one of them? One of them is to run as candidates, and this should be one of the tenets of this party, as Bernie Sanders has run, and as I ran two of my campaigns as a Socialist Alternative candidate, which is to pledge to take no corporate money. This is extremely critical. This is a fundamental thing that we need to have to distinguish this party from the Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats and Republicans right now are bought out by Wall Street interests, by the billionaire class. And that is exactly why, even though Sanders is so tremendously popular, I mean, there's been a historic breakthrough in getting young people involved in politics because they support his call for a political revolution. Even though that's happening, the Democratic establishment has done everything in its power to undermine his campaign. Why is that? It's because they are hostile to a working class agenda of single-payer healthcare, $15 an hour, all of the things that people want to fight for in terms of social change, including fighting against racism. So breaking from corporations and corporate money is absolutely essential. Another essential thing for this party is to run independent and in defiance of the establishment party, meaning that such a party should have and needs to have the courage to run against Democrats and Republicans in all kinds of local races, whether it's city council, state legislature, or congressional races, because we need to present that left alternative. And I know that what's uppermost on people's minds is the concern about, when, you know, what if Trump becomes the president? What do we do about the right? It is absolutely correct to be worried and actually terrified at the prospect of such a right-wing ideology gaining any kind of traction. But the problem is not that a mass of America is right-wing. The problem is that the mass of America does not have a left-wing alternative to the right-wing agenda. That is precisely why Trump is getting such an echo. So if we want to fight Trump, we better start building the left.
So you seem to be saying that what is missing here is a political space with a party in it for people who are actually to the left of the corporate-run Democratic Party.
Absolutely. I mean, the defining feature of American consciousness right now is an anger against corporate domination of politics, anger against the bailouts, anger against the billionaire class, and a hunger to have a reversal against the economic inequality, a hunger to fight racism and sexism, and a real urgency to achieve full rights for immigrant people, for LGBTQ communities, a real thirst to fight against climate change, which means breaking away from big oil, and that consequently means breaking away from the parties that represent the interests of big oil. So for all of this to happen, we need to build a party that is free from the stranglehold of the Republican and Democrat duopoly. And the reason Trump has gained any echo, and the reason the Tea Party made gains in 2010, is not because America is turning right-wing. I mean, obviously, there are racist, xenophobic elements in every society right now, but the vast majority of people who are being drawn towards Trump is their anger against corporate domination. And the reason the Tea Party was able to win victories at the state and congressional levels in 2010 is because there was a massive disappointment at the complete inaction from the Obama administration on any of the issues that people voted in historic numbers for him on. And so if we really want to learn some lessons from what happened then we have to be worried not only about Trump, but the fact that if we don't build a left alternative, then the danger we face is not only about Trump himself, but of an ongoing basis, an ongoing platform for growing the right wing. And that's what we are really up against. And the only way to fight it is to actually build the left. And as a matter of fact, the way to not build against the right would be to have the epitome of the hated establishment, which is Hillary Clinton, and say, here it is, you know, if you, your alternative to Trump is Hillary Clinton, that doesn't work. And you can see that playing out in polls. You know, you see poll after poll shows that Clinton will probably defeat Trump. I think that is the most likely scenario. But what you see in the numbers is that Bernie Sanders is likely to deliver a thumping defeat to Donald Trump. And so what the story that is telling us, the narrative that emerges from these polls, is that what people are really hungry for is a left challenge to corporate domination of America.
Bernie Sanders, in terms of his own statements, has given no indication that he's ready to leave the Democratic Party. What chances are there for this project to create what looks like a social Democratic Party if Bernie Sanders demurs?
That's a very good question. So, which, you know, one of the things that your question is driving towards is the fact that we, you know, on the ground, those of us who are interested in building a mass movement for a real social transformation of American society, then for us, regardless of what Bernie himself does, we need to build towards an independent party for the 99%. And as my recent article in the Counterpunch says, you know, it is not about Bernie, it's about our movement. But at the same time, I think we also have to recognize how much Bernie himself has moved throughout the campaign because not only of the support of the people around him, you know, the millions of people who are rallying around him, but also because they want a real challenge to corporate politics. So he has been pushed by them. And so that is why I have launched a petition on movementforbernie.org website where I'm urging him to run an independent. Thousands of people have signed it. I would urge all your listeners to also sign it. You know, even if Bernie does not do what we want him to do, which is run as an independent, this petition is a basis to really call for a left agenda. And, you know, there's also a People's Summit happening in Chicago in June where I will be speaking, and this is what I'm going to be speaking about, which is how do we build this movement despite whatever happens in this presidential election, and why simply hunkering down and supporting the Democratic Party establishment, which is deeply hostile to our interests, is not the answer to fight against the right.
Kashama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party in Seattle, Washington. Paul Street is an historian, an activist, and an author who wrote early on that Barack Obama was a corporate politician who, as president, would side with Wall Street and the Pentagon. Paul Street's latest book is titled They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy. Street says Hillary Clinton will pull the Democratic Party even further to the right, packing it with Republicans who prefer her to Donald Trump.
The election is shaping up with all these strange bedfellows, and I know one of the Koch brothers, I don't know both of them, I know Charles Koch's come over, said he's going to be with Hillary before he's going to be for Trump. A bunch of neocon foreign policy operatives who were in the Bush-Cheney administration, who go back to PNAC, the People for a New American Century, who were behind the Iraq War. Robert Kagan, well, being one of the leaders of these, there's a bunch of them, but Robert Kagan is the name that comes to mind, who, by the way, is the husband of, what is it, Victoria Nuland, who was a key State Department operative under Hillary Clinton, responsible for the coup, a right-wing fascist coup against the democratically elected government of Ukraine under Hillary Clinton. Anyway, Robert Kagan's married to her. Henry Kissinger, I like to call it KKK, the Koch, Kagan, and Kissinger. And there's more. The Bushes are talking about that they will line up with Hillary Clinton. And this is all supposed to be strange bedfellows that they would be wrapped up with Hillary Clinton. And I guess the narrative sort of assumes, or it's notion of strange bedfellows is based on the idea that, what, Hillary and Bill represent some kind of left-wing or left-leaning or a liberal element in the American political system. Well, they might just sort of doctrinally and officially, but in reality, anyone who studied the Clintons and looked at their history, and really this is a very good time for people to read a couple books about Hillary. One is called My Turn. It's by Doug Henwood, good New York-based, Brooklyn-based Marxist writer. The other one is by the wonderful left foreign policy writer Diana Johnstone, and it's called Queen of Chaos. Henwood's book just lays out very, very readably, very, very brilliantly, Hillary and the Clintons' history as corporate, militantly corporate, neoliberal, basically de facto moderate Nixon, Eisenhower Republicans, incredibly friendly to the business class from the very beginnings of their political careers, from the 70s all the way up through the Clinton administration. And today, I mean, Hillary might be posing as a populist. She might be pretending to care that the working class is getting screwed and the rules of the game are rigged for the wealthy few, but it's all just posturing. It's the standard American Democratic Party political posturing. It's the standard manipulation of populism by elitism. I mean, so that's their history, and Henwood talks about that. And then Diana Johnstone goes into very brilliant and readable depth on Hillary's history as a warmonger, a vicious warmonger, a fierce advocate of the invasion of Iraq, an advocate of invading Iraq even before Bush wanted to do so. Total advocate of the bombing of Serbia, the leader behind the bombing and destabilization of Libya, probably the leader in the Obama administration also of behind the destabilization of Syria, and the leader in the Obama administration of the dangerous and dysfunctional provocation of Putin's Russia, nuclear Russia, right? So I don't see how it would be very odd. I mean, even Rand Paul, the right-wing Republican senator from Kentucky, has referred to Hillary Clinton as a neocon, certainly in the foreign policy realm. I mean, she's got a arch-imperial mass murderer named Henry Kissinger, who was sort of the chief architect of Vietnam policy under Richard Nixon, is a self-described very close friend and a close advisor. So I don't find it very odd that neocons and Flemish big business people come over there. You know, and I hope American progressives, and I hope Americans who follow politics in general, have got their seats adjusted and their seatbelts adjusted properly, because the whiplash is going to be remarkable. The Democratic Party is about to go from being the party that allows a self-declared democratic socialist, not really a socialist, but a genuine progressive left-of-center Democrat, go very, very far in the primary process and make something of a kerfuffle of a serious run for the presidential nomination. They're about to go from being that party to the Bernie Sanders party to becoming really objectively the truer and more fully, explicitly ruling class party in the country right now. You've got Donald Trump. He actually, unlike Sanders, he actually had a revolution. He had a political revolution in the Republican Party. He actually blew up the Republican Party. This is really a guy who, even though he's a wealthy billionaire, a mega billionaire and a real estate developer and so forth, is kind of off the standard ruling class Council on Foreign Relations, corporate neoliberal leash. He really kind of is, in a crazy, wacky, wild card kind of way. And in his campaign rhetoric, he says things that particularly white, working, and lower middle class people like against corporate so-called free trade, which are really investor right deals, against corporate globalization, against corporations who close down their plants in America and then set them up again in low-wage parts of the world economic system. He also says these strange kind of isolationist sounding things, which are sort of oddly juxtaposed with all his white nationalism and his militarism. But he says he's very critical of some of the big imperial nation building and regime change operations that the Clintonites, the Kissingerites, and the Kaganites of both parties, you know, have always been behind. Like, he's against the invasion of Iraq. He says he's against what happened in Libya. He says it was a mistake. It was a disaster. The same for Syria. He doesn't think we should be, you know, confronting Russia in the aggressive and dangerous and provocative kinds of ways that Obama and Hillary have been doing. And you get a bunch of working class, white, particularly white working class people. We don't have a lot of black, Latino, or Muslim working class people behind him because he's racist, unfortunately. He's a white nationalist, in fact. He even sounds like a fascist sometimes. But a bunch of these white working class, frustrated people who've been completely abandoned by the elite, upper class, upper middle class, Democratic Party showing up at Donald Trump rallies and getting ready to vote for Donald Trump. And so what's so strange about that?
With the neocons and the Republican Party-based section of the capitalist ruling class moving closer, therefore, to the Democratic Party in reaction to Trump, how can Bernie Sanders supporters coexist in the Democratic Party with another overload of those elements?
You know, Bernie can. Bernie most certainly can, as far as I'm concerned. Beneath and beyond all the credit that Bernie Sanders superstar has gotten from left progressives, many of whom I think should know better, behind all the credit they've given him for making a fight out of it and contesting the nomination. I really don't think he ever seriously contested Clinton's nomination in a life or death kind of way. I don't think he ever really went for the gold. I don't think he really wanted to or had his eyes on the prize. I think he did better than Hillary expected it to, but I think he also did better than he expected him to, and then he was ready to, and then maybe even more than he wanted to. I really think Bruce Dixon was right. His assigned kind of role when he came in was to help Hillary make the Democratic nomination look like less of a coronation than was shaping up to be once Elizabeth Warren didn't get in it. They were scared as hell of Elizabeth Warren, but she might have won it. She didn't get in. They had another problem, which was going to look too easy, and he was supposed to just kind of have a little bit of a challenge and play this, you know, what Bruce calls a sheepdog role, what Bruce Dixon calls a sheepdog role, which is rally disaffected, alienated, properly so, disgruntled Democrats who are always disappointed in this party, which pretends to be the party of the people and always ends up being the party of Goldman Sachs and the Pentagon, under Obama, under Bill Clinton before that, under Jimmy Carter before that. And his job was, and Bernie's job was, sort of rally those people and increase turnout. He damn well said that, just about said that, that's what his role was. And he said from the beginning that he would line up behind whoever the eventual nominee was. Everybody knew that meant Hillary Clinton. He stayed away from the email scandal, which is a real thing, and which he would not have stayed away from if he was really in the race. He stayed away from Benghazi and a broader understanding of the imperial context behind that, which he would not have stayed away from if he was really going for the kill. He wouldn't have just been talking about some Goldman Sachs transcripts and campaign contributions. If he was really going for the gusto and going for the kill, he would have teased out and talked about and denounced the long-standing role of the Clintons as leaders, as being an historical vanguard of the reactionary far right-wing fanatical turn of the Democratic Party in the 1980s and the 1990s. I mean, I could go on with various things. He would have seriously and radically, more militantly, contested the black vote and called out the deep, vicious, underlying racism, racism of the Clinton machine going back to the beginning of their, you know, mass incarceration is incidental. He would talk about the racial viciousness of the crime bill that Clinton passed, and which, by the way, Sanders himself voted for in the 90s, and he would talk about the vicious racism of the welfare reform so-called measure that was passed in. He can go along with it. He said he was going to go along with it all along. But he attracted more and support and more radical support and more progressive support and more anti-Clinton support than I think he knew he was going to attract. Not more than I thought he was going to attract, because that's sort of on the ground here in Iowa when the whole thing got started and sensed it. People hate Hillary Clinton. Campus town progressives, working class people, just a whole bunch of people for very good reasons hate Hillary Clinton, see her as status quo, see her as establishment. They're absolutely right to do so. And, you know, just how many of them This is going to be a very interesting moment when Bernie has to make it official. I mean, he's already pretty much cashed in, and he's laid off staffers, and he has said that he's going to Philadelphia to the convention to contest the platform. Well, that means not the nomination, and the platform's a joke anyway, because nobody pays any attention to major party platform. But when he makes to give his speeches in which he tries to literally sheepdog, or maybe the analogy is Judas goat, to shepherd these people all over to this candidate who epitomizes everything that he claims to have been against, and certainly everything that many of his supporters actually are against. I mean, like this ultimate epitome. She's a right-wing fanatic, arch-corporatist, imperialist war hawk. I don't know how he pulls that off. And I've seen estimates that only half of his people will go over and actually do that, to 75%, to some guy on Counterpunch today said 95%. I don't know.
Despite the fact that Bernie Sanders has not said a word of encouragement for those who think that he might break with the Democratic Party, Kashama Sawant of the Socialist Alternative Party out of Seattle has launched a petition calling on Sanders to lead the struggle to build an independent political party and to run as a third-party candidate this time around.
Well, that's a violation of what I understood the original agreement was about a year ago in Chicago at the Independent Left Electoral Conference to petition him when everybody knew this moment was coming. We just didn't know when. I personally thought it would be a little bit sooner. But anyway, we all knew it was coming. And I thought the idea of the agreement there was to petition him to go over to the Green Party. I don't know if it was to be that, to run as a Green Party person or to just ally with or move his people over to Jill Stein and the Green Party. So I was a little surprised to hear that. I'm not completely surprised, because Socialist Alternative, which is an explicitly Marxist, calls itself Trotskyist. I know a lot of Trotskyists who wouldn't agree, but calls itself a Trotskyist Marxist organization. And the Green Party, which does not at all describe itself quite that way, you know, they're different, very different types of beasts, and they have sort of different histories and ideologies. I guess I'm not, you know, surprised, as I initially, the first time I heard about it, I thought. But in any event, I think Kashami Sawant, I've heard her speak, I've read pieces by her. She's very smart, and I think she's being clever there. I mean, she's too smart to not know that Sanders has said repeatedly that he will not be a Ralph Nader. That's the phrase. Liberal Democrats find it very convenient to blame Ralph Nader for George Bush's victory in 2000. So he's not going to be a spoiler. That's what he said. So I think what she's doing is trying to sort of hedge her bets and cover Socialist Alternatives, provide a little cover for Social Alternatives to say, technically, I think it's a good move, to say, hey, we tried. We invited Bernie to come over here and do this, because there's a lot of young people still, they're first-time voters. This thing of a progressive Democrat running and sucking up all the energy and getting everybody all excited and sheepdogging, Bruce Dixon's phrase, sheepdogging, it's an old role. Howard Dean did it. Dennis Kucinich has done it. John Edwards tried to do it in 08. But it hasn't been done for a while, because 2012 was a vacuum, because it was an incumbent. So there's a lot of first-time voters now who haven't seen this before. They haven't seen a progressive Democrat who sounds more radical than he really is come along the sheepdog. Folks are still kind of a little bit in love with him, and I think she knows that. There's just a lot of cult energy, and there's a lot of daddy energy surrounding the Bernie Sanders superstar. So she knows that. So she wants to say that we asked him, we invited him, and then it's sort of on him to have rejected that. And then you're banking on some sort of backlash from mainly young folks, not just young folks, when they realize that, hey, this guy wasn't as left as he really said he was, because if he was, he sure as hell wouldn't be telling us to go vote for a right-wing fanatic, arch-corporatist, military war hawk named Hillary Clinton. And the idea is to sweep into the left. I don't know. I don't know if that's going to work or not.
But what about the prospects for a third party that would be essentially social democratic and take up the space that the Democratic Party falsely claims?
Well, that would be the Green Party, because they've done the most work in trying to get on ballots, and they have a history in that regard. I know they're on the ballot in my state. I suspect by election time they'll be on the ballot in most of the states. They know how to do that. They're sort of ideologically all over the map in different kinds of ways. And what would be neat is if the more progressive and left and vanguard elements that come out of Sanders' thing, who get it, that the Democratic Party, that you can't have a revolutionary movement in a counter-revolutionary party, would go in there, perhaps, along with people like myself, perhaps, who were too left to have ever been part of the Sanders thing, and there's a lot of us, like people like us, left-wing radical revolutionary social movements, often allied with third or fourth parties, always sort of were our plan A, not our plan B. Because some of those lefties for whom the third party might be their plan B, allied with lefties for whom independent revolutionary movements and politics were always plan A, probably your best avenue right now electorally. I realize there's other sectarian organizations that sometimes make it on the ballot, like the Socialist Equality Party and the Party of Liberation and Socialism. I can't remember all the various names, the alphabet soup of the different parties or other. But the Green Party's best avenue for that. And I think that the Bernie phenomena, even though he's not actually a socialist, he's not a democratic socialist, his success while being affiliated with that label and not swearing it off shows that there are a bunch of people in this country, young people who are ready to call themselves socialists, and who knows, maybe to really fight in serious ways, you know, beyond voting booths and beyond going to a voting booth for 2 minutes once every 4 years for socialism, which, by the way, is what we need if we want to survive and have a decent future. I think the Green Party needs to start calling itself explicitly. It's got to work that into its rhetoric, and I think the Sanders thing shows that they should do that. They call themselves democratic socialists as well as environmentalists. And I really don't see why anybody anymore thinks we're going to have an environmental. We need an environmental revolution. But just like you're not going to have a democratic political revolution and a counter-revolutionary party, you're not going to have an environmental, earth-saving transformation of ecology under capitalism. And that means we need eco-socialism. So it's time for the Green Party. It would help me come along and be more active in it than I tend to be. I tend to sort of just vote for it. So it's my protest vote. It would explicitly call itself that and talk more about workers' power and workers' control and highlight race, which is so intimately, racism and racial inequality, which is so intimately interrelated and interwoven with all of our other oppression structures in this country.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.